used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
And the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Show, Canada's only radio show and podcast on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is CFRO 100.5 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada, on Friday, March 22nd, 2019. For the next hour, I'm your host, Jen Dobell, and I'm joined in studio by my co-host, Allison Cole.
Hi there.
Today's show features a roundtable discussion between myself and some local animal rights activists, most of whom recently attended an event hosted by UBC Sustainability Ambassadors entitled Hope in the Climate Crisis, Transitioning Our World, featuring a speech by renowned environmentalist and scientist David Suzuki. A panel discussion and Q&A followed, featuring the UBC professors from the sustainability sector, and our discussion today tackles the question often asked by vegan activists: why is there so much resistance to veganism within the environmental activist community and from the major environmental groups such as Greenpeace and the Green Party? We will first speak with the vegan animal rights activists, some of whom attended the event, followed by an interview with one of the panelists, a UBC professor and marine biologist, Daniel Polly, of the UBC Institute for Oceans and Fisheries and project leader for the Sea Around Us project. Let's listen to that now.
Hi, my name is Patricia Kendall. I'm a retired municipal lawyer from here in Vancouver. And since retirement, I've been an adjunct faculty member at UBC. I'm participating in this program as a member of the public and not in my capacity as a UBC faculty member.
My name is Michael. I am a graduate physics student. I work at a laboratory at the University of British Columbia.
My name is Emily. I'm just a private citizen who's interested in environmental issues.
I'm Roy. I'm a former Royal Canadian Navy sailor turned Sea Shepherd officer turned animal rights activist in Vancouver.
So on Monday night this week, some of us were at UBC for an event called Hope in the Climate Crisis, Transitioning Our World. And Jen thoughtfully suggested that some of us vegans go so that we could ask some pointed questions about veganism during the question and answer period. So the keynote speaker was Dr. David Suzuki, and there were four other panelists who were UBC professors. So I was intrigued by the flyer for this event because it said, "Join us for a provocative evening of discussion." I'm like, provocative? That seems like an invitation. And the speakers were described as UBC's finest academics who are setting a precedent of climate leadership. So I was very interested in the concept of climate leadership.
You must have had some high hopes. I would have, hearing that. And the title of the event was Hope, wasn't it?
Hope.
What was the exact title?
Hope in the Climate Crisis.
Right. So you had high expectations for that.
Exactly. So I walked in, and it was a huge room, packed room. So there was an announcement at one point that the room was, that the it was sold out at 400 people.
Wow.
And 99% of them were students. So there was a stage with a podium for Dr. Suzuki to speak. Mm-hmm. And then there was a semicircle of a kind of loungy chairs on the stage for the other panelists. So I expected that that the question and answer period would have a stand-up microphone in the aisles. So I'm like, I want to make sure that I can get right up to the front and be first in line if possible to ask a question. Mm-hmm. So I sat right in the front row, kind of in front of the panelists' chairs. And while I was waiting for it to start, I was talking to a few students around me. And they were from, oh, I can't remember exactly, but food sciences, land and agriculture, like, and I was like, so have you seen the movie Cowspiracy? And they were like, no, I think I've sort of heard of it. I'm like, mm-hmm. I'm kind of shocked, really. Mm-hmm. I said, really? I said, I almost feel like the viewing that film should be a requirement for you to have admission to your program. So mm-hmm. anyway, they looked at me a bit shocked. Anyway, so the The program began, and the students who were introducing the evening said, oh, we're going to use an online question format, and it's called Slido. So you here's the event code, and get out your cell phones and type your question in, and then you can vote on which questions you want the panel to answer. And only the most popular questions will be asked. Mm. So my heart just sank because I'm like, oh, there goes my chance, really.
Right.
So I carefully inputted a very thoughtful question, and it came back 250 too many characters. Oh, so I kept reducing. By the time my question got reduced, I didn't even like it, and of course it didn't get voted on. So I was actually feeling frustration right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So the first speaker was David Suzuki, and I had never heard him speak before. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you, I was really impressed. Mm-hmm. He is super intelligent. He's engaging. He's likable. And I learned a lot. I thought it was amazing. And so everything I'm going to say about David Suzuki tonight is not a personal attack. My sole reason for saying things that I will later say that appear critical of him is just that we're looking for climate leaders. Mm-hmm. So I was really examining him from a perspective of leadership. So what was great about his presentation is he gave a very good, I'm going to say, historical review from past decades of the what I would call the politics of climate change. Mm-hmm. And he's an authority. And I was like, wow, this is excellent. And he really drove home to the audience of how completely dire the situation is. Mm-hmm. And at one point he said, we need a declaration of war against climate change. Mm-hmm. So I was like, great. But then his entire focus, I think he spoke for 45 minutes, his entire focus was on fossil fuels and nothing on animal agriculture, human diet, food consumption.
And this is why, Pat, I always ask animal rights activists to attend these environmental events, because we know this is how this goes, and we needed a representation there.
Right,
so
and I wasn't the
you
only
up.
One.
You weren't the only vegan. One. There were a few right. of you that showed up. That's great.
And one thing Dr. Suzuki said that really felt like a call to me personally was he, now, by the way, for those of you who obviously can't see me, I'm not a young person. I'm 67. And David Suzuki basically said, we need elders who no longer have to kiss anyone's behind to get a job or get a raise or get a promotion. Elders, for God's sake, he said, get off that couch. Mm-hmm. Get off the golf course and come and support these young kids and tell them the truth. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, you know, I'm an elder. I hear you. Mm-hmm. So after he spoke, they said, let's take a few online questions. So one of the questions that was asked was a question from this group about plant-based eating, and it was directed towards Dr. Suzuki. And basically, he said, eating plant-based, it's where we should all be going. So I was like, great. But then he gave a kind of a little nervous laugh, and he said, I'm Japanese. I eat fish. I catch fish. I only catch to kill. And I will continue to eat fish in modest amounts. But there's absolutely no question a meat-based diet is too heavy for the planet to sustain. Catholics used to eat no meat on Fridays. If all Canadians gave up meat one day a week, it would have a huge impact. Mm-hmm. Now, then he went on to talk about economics again. That was all he was, he mm-hmm. really changed the topic. So, I felt somewhat frustrated by mm-hmm. that response. So then it was time for the other panelists to talk. Mm-hmm. And one of them was someone who was a behavioral psychologist and was talking about what is needed to impel humans to change their behavior. And this speaker asked the audience generally, how many hamburgers do we have to give up to offset a flight from New York to London? Shout out your answers. So Dr. Suzuki shouted out 5,000, and the person said, wow, David Suzuki thinks that, you know, this flight is equivalent to eating 5,000 hamburgers. The answer is 350. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a demonstration of how he wasn't really knowledgeable about the effects of meat eating.
Right.
So the speaker went on to say, one hamburger is equivalent to every 10 miles of flight. We need to know what our carbon footprint is.
Right.
So at the end, there was just, then there was another speaker, Professor Daniel Pauly, and one of the students in the audience asked, where is hope? Which was the title of the program. Mm-hmm. Where is hope? As young people, where is our energy best spent? And Professor Pauly said, hell raising. And he really didn't had much time because this was getting near the end, but he said, nothing has changed through people's stomachs. If you think you can change the world by eating right, you are wrong. You can only change by raising hell. So I have to say that I interpreted that as undermining the value of veganism. Mm-hmm. But I know we're going to be speaking with him later in the program.
Right.
So he will have an opportunity to clarify
his
answer.
He will be elaborating on that.
Yeah. So finally, there was really five chairs on the platform, and the one closest to me was empty, and it was designed for David Suzuki to sit in, mm-hmm. but he just kept standing at the podium. So the moderator happened to sit right in front of me, mm-hmm. and then the moderator was like, well, we have a few more minutes here, and it's been all faculty talking so far tonight, so let's open it up to students. Let's hear what you have to say. So some students started calling out questions, which were very hard for me to hear mm-hmm. because there was no amplification. Mm-hmm. And I was like, here's my chance. Mm-hmm. So I scooted over a few seats. And then when there was a break between questions, I waved at the moderator mm-hmm. and got his attention. I was right in front of him. And he pointed at me, but he pointed at me with his hand holding the mic.
Great.
And I just grabbed the mic.
That's what you needed to do. You had to take control of the situation.
So, you know what? I listened back and I didn't sound that fierce, but I felt fierce in the moment. Mm-hmm. And I said, I know you've opened this session up to students, but I'm a faculty member. Mm-hmm. And I heard Dr. Suzuki's call for the elders to step forward. And I also heard the other, Professor Pauly's challenge to raise hell. So I'm here standing as an elder, raising some hell. And I'm going to say that I'm disappointed with tonight's presentation. And you know, I heard an audible gasp.
I love those words. It's perfect.
And I said, you know, I have done a lot of research on the environmental impact of animal agriculture and the pillaging, the ravaging of our oceans for human food consumption. Mm-hmm. And the impact is huge. And I said, you know, we need leaders. Right? We need leaders.
Yeah.
And I said, we need leaders who are environmentalists, not just academically, but they need to be leaders at home. They need to be environmental leaders at the dinner table.
Fantastic.
And I said, you know, as I said, you can see my white hair here, my silver hair, and I'm raising hell, and I'm just going to say, I don't think anyone has the right to call themselves an environmentalist unless they're a vegan.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
And then I
handed the microphone back to them, and I was just looking eye to eye at Dr. Suzuki, and you know, I didn't mean it as a personal attack. I really mean we need leaders with integrity.
Right.
Leading from the front. You call it leading from the front. You don't only call the shots, but you also show how to do it.
Right. Yeah. So,
and you said he had a bit of a stunned look on his face.
Well, you know, it was just a real end of the night questions and answers.
And right. And yours was a comment, not a question, but right. I still like that you left David Suzuki looking a bit stunned and hopefully planted a seed.
I hope.
Mm-hmm.
I hope. So, you know, at the end, after the whole program, I'm still left in a state of being perplexed. Mm-hmm. I'm just perplexed because I, you know, as I thought about it on the bus on the way home, I'm like, every vegan is automatically an environmentalist. Even if it's not something that they personally identify with, just by virtue of being a vegan, you're an environmentalist. So I'm like, why? I do not understand why environmentalists are not also vegan.
Well, Pat, because you are new to veganism and a bit newer to activism, I'll just let you know that this isn't surprising to me anymore, but when I first encountered these things, it was. And I ended up leaving Greenpeace after I saw Cowspiracy because of their unwillingness to
talk about veganism as a solution.
Right.
I also used to give money to the David Suzuki Foundation. I stopped because looking at their website, they're not doing enough to promote veganism. They're suggesting reducing to one meat meal, having only one meat meal a day.
Mm-hmm.
You will come to see this, and you will come to understand again why I want activists to attend these events. I'm always working and I can't go, but I always promote them on Facebook and ask people to show up,
right,
and represent the animals. And we will keep doing that,
mm-hmm,
and we'll keep talking like you did,
right,
and get that message out.
And at one point, David Suzuki spoke about the phenomena or the perspective that he called reductionism, which is like isolating nature in its very singular aspects without seeing the full context, losing sense of the context. And he said, that's not the way that nature works. And I'm like, by environmentalists seeing the climate crisis purely from this perspective of fossil fuels and energy use, it's that very perspective of reductionism. It's not seeing everything in the full context.
Right. Well, we can follow up with an email for sure, and I would like to hear his response.
And I just felt that it didn't leave people with hope, because when we're dealing with big issues like energy consumption, you know, as a nation, and I mean, these are huge political questions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But veganism is something people can do individually now.
To feel hopeful. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, and maybe I'm saying this because I have a lot of fervor and passion as a new vegan,
mm-hmm,
and as a new activist.
But you'll find it only gets worse.
Oh my goodness. But I just want to say before we go on to a broader discussion is that I'm here speaking as an ordinary person,
mm-hmm,
and I just and what I'm bringing to the table is showing what an ordinary person with a little bit of spark can do in the right circumstances. There's nothing special about me. Or if there is something special, it's special that a specialness that everybody has.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, becoming a vegan is probably the single best thing I have done in my entire life.
Happy to hear that. It's something that is said quite often.
Yes.
Right.
And, you know, there's, you know, I can say how I was influenced to become a vegan by what I call the triple films, What the Health, Cowspiracy, and Land of Hope and Glory.
Mm-hmm.
I can say how I was influenced to become a vegan by your Facebook posts, mm-hmm, Jen, very influenced. But the main thing was that when I retired 4 years ago, I was in extremely, extremely poor health,
mm-hmm,
and it was scary,
yeah,
and I just had this very strong sense that truthfully, I'd never met a vegan. I just thought that was just way off the chart for me, but I was like, I need to become a vegetarian,
mm-hmm,
and you know, I'm just going to say, I don't know what the time is, but I'm just going to say that in my life, I've seen my life as a process of what I would call purifications.
Mm-hmm.
I left a very fundamentalist Christian religion when I was a young person at great cost to myself and ended up being shunned by half my family. I left a very abusive relationship. I quit drugs. I quit smoking cigarettes. I quit dyeing my hair. I quit wearing nail polish. I quit drinking alcohol. And with each purification, I found I was becoming more and more sensitive, which is great, and it's also bad, because then when something is off, I really feel it. And something, mm-hmm, was very off. And now that I have become vegan, it's the most incredible feeling of health and lightness. And the way I can say it is that if you eat an apple, you're eating a food that starts with a seed that's nurtured from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the apple is grown with light from the sun, and it's nourished with water. And so when we eat the apple and it's dissolved and integrated into our bodies, we are receiving that light from the sun. We are receiving the grounding from the earth. We're receiving the clarity and purity of the water.
Mm-hmm.
But when we eat meat, that animal was conceived through artificial insemination, which is, let's just say it's rape.
Mm-hmm.
And the males are also sexually manipulated.
Right.
It's just nasty from the start. They live in these horrible circumstances in darkness or artificial light. Mm-hmm. They're fed antibiotics. They're fed animal byproducts, sometimes of their own species. It's like a cannibalism. And then when they die, it's like this incredible fear. And that is within their flesh. Mm-hmm. When we eat that, we're integrating that into our flesh.
Yeah.
And I just felt that I was just feeling a great deal of a different physical and emotional and mental symptoms that were extremely disturbing to me. And I feel it was just the sensitivity to this energy from eating animals.
Yeah.
And so I'm so happy to say that that's been released. So there were so many issues brought up on Monday. And, you know, when David Suzuki spoke about Japanese, I have to say, in my mind, I was like, well, you know, I come from a German family. Mm-hmm. My grandparents were cattle ranchers in southern Alberta, and I grew up with beef and, you know, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that we are bound by our heritage. Mm-hmm. You know, we are on a fast evolutionary track. And so, I mean, we're being called to outgrow and evolve beyond our heritage. So.
I find it really ironic that he made an excuse like that after spending 45 minutes trying to get everybody to take action.
Right. And so I know other people have thoughts about this heritage issue.
Everybody else here at the table, well, Roy, you didn't attend the event, but Emily and Michael, you did. So do you want to just give us your thoughts on David Suzuki's comments?
Pat, just like at the actual event, I think you explained it perfectly. At the event, I think all me and all the other vegans that were there wanted ourselves or somebody to say exactly what you said. And I feel the same way right now. You said absolutely everything that that I wanted to say about this. I just want to reiterate, it's especially important for people like David Suzuki and also for anybody who becomes a leader in the environmentalist movement to lead by example, to go vegan, to try the zero waste thing and eventually get good at that also, and to do this publicly. We're often shamed for being so-called preachy vegans, for shoving our beliefs down other people's throats. And we're told we're doing that just by living as vegans and by saying that we're vegans, but
already raising hell, right?
Yeah, yeah. The fact that the very act of us being vegan is so offensive to people shows how sensitive they are to seeing the actions of others. This is why I wish people like that were vegan, and even students at UBC who lead climate rallies and things like that. I make it a point to ask them to consider their own choices.
And Emily, did you have any thoughts?
Oh, well, most of what I was thinking about has already been said. I suppose it is just, I think Pat pointed out fundamentally the fact that the consumption of fish was almost excused by an appeal to heritage and past tradition, I thought was somewhat ironic, given that in some ways the crux of the current climate crisis is stemming from the fact that we have been continuously doing sort of the same things that we've been doing for years and years, like using fossil fuels, burning fossil fuels, engaging in this kind of throwaway culture. In order for us to avoid these catastrophes, we need to radically change the way that we think about our place in the world and our relationship to the ecosystem. We have to essentially throw away almost a like centuries old just sort of sense of ourselves, you know, man as being kind of the leader of this planet and having the right to take whatever we want and to expand infinitely. We really need to sort of question all of these past beliefs and things. So this is really the time for all of us to just evaluate all the things that we consider just to be norms of our life and ask, like, is it really in that, you know, now is it worth sort of hanging on to that, and what is the justification for hanging on to that? We really need to kind of evaluate all of our choices now in light of the best available evidence, and I think too to apply just the precautionary principle to things. I mean, why why just give up meat one day of the week, right? I mean, like, if you could just give it up every day of the week, would that not be better? And should we not just do the best thing if it's not that much of a sacrifice? Because we don't really have that much time anymore. Mm-hmm. Things are very dire. And I wish people would kind of realize that. And I think that the problem with that talk was that, it was in a sort of bizarre way. It was very kind of depressingly prophetic. He said, we're essentially over the cliff now, you know, and we're falling down. But then in this sort of strange way, because there wasn't really a tangible plan given for what we should do as either private citizens or as public hellraisers, it's one of those things where you can easily leave an event like that feeling kind of like you've accomplished something by just having gone, but having no real idea of how to change your own behavior or anybody else's behavior, or even what to argue government should try to do to change people's behavior en masse. So, yeah, I don't know. Kind of a letdown, I would say.
And Roy, you didn't attend, but I'm tokenizing you here as my Japanese vegan friend. What would you say to David Suzuki for using being Japanese?
I would say the same thing that I was saying to him through the video when I saw him responding. Like, just for some background, like, David Suzuki was a hero of mine growing up. Like, he was interned in World War II. He wrote a book that talked about animals and was a big influence in my becoming vegan, like just talking about abusing squirrels and when he was fishing and how he started to really think about, is this okay to do? And I started to ask myself, is this okay to do? So it's very disappointing a few times in the past few years of my life to hear the types of things he's saying, like promoting fishing, and again, this time appealing to heritage as an excuse to continue eating fish. And here I am looking at myself, maybe I'm just a Nisei, second generation, sorry, David, but, I don't feel a need to, you know, conquer Asia and invade countries next to me. I don't feel a need to do other horrible things that Japan has done. I don't feel a need to go whaling illegally. I don't feel a need to slaughter dolphins. I fought for Sea Shepherd against that, and there's people in Japan fighting against that who are bucking the trend of, or at least bucking their traditions, their upbringing, to do the right thing. And I hope that maybe, even at his age, he might be willing to at least say that it is the right thing.
That's a great answer. And so, Michael and Emily, you wanted to talk a little bit more about the environmental impact on fishery industry as well as the animal agriculture industry that did not get talked about that evening, and we all feel should have. Did you want to just give our listeners some information?
A few facts. So for the animal agriculture industry, everybody I think is familiar with its contribution to emissions. There's a lot of methane that comes from cow manure, and estimates vary. It's the number that scientists seem to most agree on is 18% of all greenhouse gas emissions come from cattle and livestock themselves. But another huge factor that people don't think about, and I actually wrote this on a piece of paper that I handed to David Suzuki at this discussion, is that about 91% of deforestation, at least in South America, is for the sake of animal agriculture. And this is because they're clearing land so quickly to make room for grazing and to grow feed crops to feed these animals. And the reason we promote veganism is that it's so much more efficient to grow food and to feed the plants to people directly, as opposed to growing the food, feeding it to animals, letting those animals live for however long it takes for them to grow big enough to slaughter. And actually, for grass-fed beef, it takes longer for this to happen than it does for intensive factory farm raised. But either way, it's so much less efficient to get our food this way than it is to just grow food to eat directly. It's basic physics. Every time you go up the food chain, every time you go up in a trophic level, you lose energy and matter. So that's the reason why animal agriculture contributes to greenhouse gas emissions in two different ways: by destroying forests, by destroying CO2 sinks, and by emitting greenhouse gases itself. As for fishing, I think by now we've all heard about the reports that seafood will not be viable by the year 2050, by the year 2048. That's according to a report published in National Geographic. But we're also now learning about the plastic waste and how big of an impact fishing has on that, it turns out most of the plastic in the ocean, most of the microplastics, comes from fishing, from used fishing gear. So while it's great to participate in zero waste initiatives, know that simply refusing to use plastic bottles isn't going to cut it. If you really care about reducing plastic in the ocean, you need to stop eating fish.
Well, just on that topic alone, Roy, my very first Animal Voices interview was with you on the experience that you had in the Sea of Cortez on a Sea Shepherd boat. Can you tell us about what you were doing on that?
Well, with Sea Shepherd, I was ultimately executive officer on the New Farley Mowat for Operation Milagro 2, trying to save the very critically endangered vaquita porpoise. I think they're down to maybe single digits now. They might have been at 100 when I was there. But basically what we were doing is we would hunt the poachers at night and pull their nets out of the water in the day. And there's a lot of nets. There's a lot of other garbage too, but you know, just to support the idea that most ocean garbage is probably plastic from fishing gear, it really looked like that. We were pulling a lot of that out. Some of it was new, which made us happy because we knew we got something that they planted recently. Some of it was definitely old and abandoned gear, which is a problem. And just to clarify, that information you're getting was from, Michael, from the National Geographic article about the study on the Pacific garbage patch. Yeah, that one's talking about 40, something people didn't quite read when at the first glance of the article, is that it says 46% of the ocean plastic, they found microplastic, I think they said, is from fishing nets. And then they go on to say, and the majority of the remainder is from other fishing gear. So if you think Michael was wrong about saying that, no, he was correct. Look at the article again, and it's staggering.
We'll link that on our Animal Voices Vancouver Facebook page, as well as in the animalvoices.org web post for this show. And Emily, did you have anything you wanted to mention on the impact on the environment of us eating animals and fish?
Most of it's already been covered. I think that maybe just one more thing to point out is that I think it's easy to think that fish is acceptable to eat because of the labeling around fish. You can go to the grocery store and there's sort of labels that are color-coded yellow, red, and green, mm-hmm. sort of indicate like how
the ocean wise labels, right?
Yeah, the ocean wise labels.
Greenwashing.
Yeah. I did some reading into these labels, and the article that I read, it was mostly specific to labeling companies that are based in the United States, but I think it is also similar in Canada, that for the most part, these labels are not issued by independent government organizations or scientific organizations. They're all private companies, and they outsource the actual auditing of the fisheries to additional private companies. And the thing about these labeling companies is that they have a very direct financial interest in fisheries and other producers of the fish products being able to use these labels. They get a licensing fee. So over 50% of the profits these companies make come from licensing fees for using the labels. And there was an interesting spike in market demand for fish after these consumer labels came out. And so the thing is that these consumer labels are based upon projections of fish stocks, assuming kind of the levels of demand and fishing that were, and also just knowledge about climate change and sort of trends that were going to be happening, right, at the time that those labels were first developed. And the data on these factors changes constantly. And in this sort of paradoxical way, the fact that the labeling system increased demand for the fish, including like McDonald's and Walmart now sell exclusively like sustainable fish to millions of people, the demand for fish is constantly increasing. And so as such, the projections for what fish stocks are going to be like in the next 20 or 30 years could be way off, and actually have been sort of demonstrated to be fairly inaccurate in certain specific cases. There was a case with, I think, a swordfish fishery in Canada where it was sort of demonstrated that a lot of the auditing of the actual fish stocks was inaccurate. So just to sort of say that we can't, again, going back to a discussion we had a few weeks ago, as consumers, we need to be extremely skeptical of labels that promote like sustainable meat, humane meat, free range, like all these things. And ultimately just don't trust it. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, especially again, the oceans too, it's the same issue. Every single time we eat a fish, we're removing a food unit for a predator, and the oceanic ecosystems are so fragile right now. And if the oceans die,
Pretty much.
Oceans die, we die.
Yeah, we die, basically. So, yeah, I just, again, it's like, why? Why do we insist on consuming these things when we don't have to and when the risk is so high? It's insane. Mm-hmm. I don't get it.
Much of the fish that is white fish is mislabeled as shark. It's mislabeled as something else. If you want to know more about the corruption in this industry, you can watch the documentary Shark Water Extinction.
And also, for anybody that's like consuming fish because they're convinced they need to get like DHA and EPA omega-3 fatty acids, fish get it from algae that they eat. And you can buy algae-based DHA and EPA omega-3 oil supplements. So, you know, there's no nutrient that fish is giving us that we can't get from a non-fish-based source. Then it'll probably be better for you, too. It's going to have, like, fewer PCBs and mercury and stuff. So,
right.
I'll just say that.
Thank
I'll just
you.
Add one little thing that hits me closer to home, maybe, because I saw it with my own eyes. Bycatch. You pull those nets out of the water, and they're not catching their intended targets.
Exactly.
They're catching porpoises. Critically endangered porpoises. They're catching turtles. They're catching sharks. We had a couple humpbacks just in the time that we were there, and who knows how often that happens. You know, it's it just keeps going and going and going. You're never getting just what you want. And even what you want sucks. So stop it.
Yeah, go vegan, everybody. I always like to wrap up with our favorite most influential websites or films for people that are influenced by our talk today and actually would like to go vegan and just don't know where to begin. Pat?
The film that pushed me over the edge was The Land of Hope and Glory. Mm-hmm. And I went downtown to watch that at Robson Square when Earthling Ed was there, but it was sort of too full and turned out I was just starving, so I was like, oh, just go home and eat and then watch it. And it was this beautiful summer night, had my windows open, and I started crying. No, that's not true. I started sobbing so loudly that I saw my neighbor coming over to my house to see what was wrong. Mm-hmm. So I had to clamp it down, but I could only watch 14 minutes. And I'm like, that's it. That's it.
Yeah, those are impactful films. For me, it was Earthlings, which is similar, and Land of Hope and Glory. Land of Hope and Glory was made because people saw Earthlings who were from the UK and they said, we don't do it that way here. And so we really did need that film, and thank you to Earthling Ed for making it. Michael?
My favorite movie of any kind, not just about veganism, is a movie called Carnage, Swallowing the Past. This movie is a bit hard to find here in North America. It's only on BBC iPlayer, but if you can get it illegally, I highly recommend watching it. It's a documentary made in the future about 50 years in the future, and it shows how England went vegan. It shows how society gradually shifted away from the unnecessary killing and suffering that the animal agriculture causes, and it shows the only future where we have a future, the future that we need to have. And to me, it's more powerful even than the documentaries that show real footage.
And Emily, do you have a web link or a film that you find really helpful for new vegans? Even a YouTube video?
No, I mean, for me it was more just reading a lot of articles, I guess. But then the film that that probably kind of pushed me over the edge would have been Dominion, which is similar to Earthlings, but I guess more recently released.
And focuses on the Australian animal agriculture?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Right. And Roy, I mean, books as well, right? Roy, what would you
I don't think I have much to add on this, but I would say that Earthlings was probably the one that really pushed me over. It was a series of conversations and some activist stuff that I saw, and ultimately a friend said, you got to watch this Earthlings film, which it pushed me over the edge. I also think that Land of Hope and Glory is going to have a big impact with people. And just to let people know, you know, Earthling had made that film, like Jen said, to show that it's not just somewhere else; it's here for people in the UK. And I can tell you right now that for anyone in Canada who's saying, "Oh, that's somewhere else," if you have the guts to go check it out yourself when no one's going to know, you know, at the farm or the slaughterhouse that you're coming in, you're going to see the same horrible stuff that you see in all the stuff that you see online that you tried to dismiss.
One of our close friends, Jeffrey Gere, was an undercover investigator all across Canada for 3 years, and he would just go work on any random farm or slaughterhouse. It could be humane certified, it could be not. It's all the same thing that you see in Earthlings. And because all of our answers focused on animal welfare, I'm just going to give a couple more suggestions. NutritionFacts.org is definitely your number one go-to website for anything on health. And I also want to recommend Cowspiracy, keeping with the theme of today's show on the impact on the environment of our food choices. And I wanted one more. What was the third? What's the triple?
What the Health.
That's a really great one. That's on Netflix. So thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. Thank you, everybody, for being here today. If you have any more questions, you can contact us at animalvoices.org, and we would all love to help you go vegan if we've inspired you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Did you know that Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, has over 90 different shows produced by over 350 community members? This wide range of programming produced by our diverse group of programmers ensures that we have a show you'll love. We have shows on feminism, spirituality, disability rights, politics, unions, and parenting. We play jazz, indie rock, reggae, blues, and folk. We broadcast in a dozen different languages and have more First Nations programs than any other radio station in Vancouver. Find your show on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. All different, all the time.
Hello, I'm Michael Cossin. I'm a graduate student at UBC, working at the Triumph Laboratory.
And I'm Emily. I'm just a member of the public interested in environmental issues, and I attended the talk on Monday.
And I'm Daniel Pauli. I'm professor of fisheries at UBC, and I was one of the panelists on Monday.
Great. Well, we really appreciate you calling in. So before we get started on the talk, I wanted to ask you about some opinions that you frequently expressed. You've said that you prefer that governments should abolish subsidies to fishing fleets.
Yes. This is not only an opinion. This is some based on a lot of studies that demonstrate by me and my colleagues and other colleagues that demonstrate that fishing can continue when stocks are exhausted if you subsidize the fishery. So if you were to not subsidize the fishery, they would cease to exploit over-exploited stocks and they could recover.
I see.
And as simple as that.
So the issue is just the amount of fish that they're removing from the ocean?
No, the issue is that they do not even benefit or profit from the fish that they catch. They profit from the fact that they extort from government subsidies to keep fishing. They don't catch enough fish to actually make a profit. They have overfished. The fisheries of the world have been overfished in the 80s and the 90s, and nowadays many fisheries fish for subsidies.
And what do you see happening if the subsidies remain in place and fishing continues?
It continues. They continue to exploit us. That's what essentially happens. The World Trade Organization has tried to deal with this, but a few countries want to get rid of subsidies, and a few countries want to keep them going because the companies control the government and they can get away with it. And the WTO, the World Trade Organization, has not been able to get a consensus on the abolition of subsidies, though official subsidies, though they were close a few years ago, a decade ago, they were close to it, and they will return to it because it's crazy to subsidize an industry that is at the edge of being bankrupt and also which emits so much superfluously greenhouse gases. So when the time comes, which I hope will, it will be that we have to deal seriously with greenhouse gas. We can cut 1 or 2% of greenhouse gases simply by removing subsidies from fleet that are not necessary, that are excessive.
What? How does fishing contribute to greenhouse gases?
They use engines.
Mm-hmm. Just the operation of the... It's pretty easy, yes. So, I think that ties into what you said at the talk. I'm beginning to understand why you said that our consumption habits, that we are never going to be able to change something with our stomachs if the governments... Is this correct?
Yes. Basically, it is the consumption habits. Obviously, this is important, but it is at the same time a distraction, because the governments are a force magnifier. For example, I don't smoke, and my friends don't smoke, but the non-smokers could not reach enough smokers to get rid of smoking. But government forbade smoking in, like, at UBC and in closed rooms, and all of a sudden the publicity on propaganda that the companies were doing, the tobacco companies were doing, were not working anymore for the 90% of the population that the non-smokers cannot reach. And this force multiplying is very important, because good deeds that we want to do, we eat the right thing, or we buy the right things, that is only reaching a number of people. Unless the government intervenes and magnifies this, it never scales up. For example, I don't eat shark fin soup, right? Shark fin soup is forbidden in the U.S. now. That is saving sharks. I can save 1 million for a shark by not eating shark fin soup. But if I can get a law passed that forbids the use of or the sale of shark fin soup, then I have this force multiplier. And therefore, our efforts should concentrate on governments, because they are force multiplier, instead of wasting time and wasting our resource of convincing our body.
Well, I thank you very much for clarifying that. We weren't really sure what you meant by that, but I think now that you've clarified that, a lot of people in this room, a few of the people in this room, agree with what you're saying. Another question I want to ask about this, the fact that shark fin soup was banned in the United States, do you think that could have happened if it was more popular than it is? If there wasn't already a huge public opinion against it?
Yeah, but this huge opinion was perhaps shared by 10% of the population. The rest didn't care. I was not aware of the problem, and happily would have ordered soup, shark fin soup, if offered. The bulk of the population doesn't care about various things. And climate change, for example, we have to reduce emissions before we convince everybody that it is necessary to reduce emissions. That's the point. You would never get a large fraction of the population agreeing that climate change requires sacrifice. But you can get perhaps half of the parliament to do that. Because in the representative democracies, the people that we elect are supposed to know a few more things than the public. That's the point again.
But if they represent a population that doesn't understand that global warming is happening and certainly isn't willing to make sacrifice to solve a problem,
okay,
that...
You need another example then. The insecticides are poisons. They are forbidden. Now, how many people are aware of insecticide being poison? And they are forbidden, or various poisons, DDT, PCB, dioxin, are forbidden because competent people and the majority of the government has voted to forbid this thing. Asbestos, for another example, is lots of people don't care about asbestos, but it has been forbidden because it makes people sick. But people have not been asked on the street what the opinion about asbestos is, Why should people have an opinion about asbestos?
Well,
the point is, you completely, when you expect the public at large to be interested, you can of assume that the public, that they have time to think about asbestos and PCB and greenhouse gases and stuff while they are thinking about making enough money to end up the week or the month. Why do we elect people to represent us? The point is, why are we supposed to, why are citizens supposed to themselves know that asbestos is bad for you? We have a medical establishment, we have a scientific establishment, we have a political establishment that is supposed to be in charge, and we try to influence them. That's how we get changed. Not by, obviously, you need to reach a certain percentage of population, but you need then a force multiplier. And if you don't, that is the government, if you don't reach into this force multiplier, it never works. Take safety belt, another example. How many people would be convinced to, by word of mouth, to use a safety belt? Perhaps 10%, 15% population. They are obligatory. Even people who don't like safety belts have to wear them. Because that's the point.
I think that the examples that you're bringing up are all characterized by the fact that the public is indifferent to and does not care about the specific issues at hand. So, for example, you pointed out that, like, as far as shark fin soup goes, I mean, it's not a typical dish in North America, really.
Yeah, we don't have to sacrifice.
Like, it's not a sacrifice. And I think that the distinction here is that if we're just talking about fish in general, that's a very, very popular food item.
No, not at all. To cut subsidies for fishing fleet that all fish is not a sacrifice to anyone. And in fact, to reduce climate change causing emission would not be a sacrifice for anyone if it were organized properly. These things are not sacrifices. These things are things that are being done because some corporation benefit from that, and we have to influence governments, our governments, to not consider the corporation first. They don't imply sacrifice.
Well, do you think there would not be any effect on the final cost of fish to consumers if subsidies were to cease? I mean, the subsidies are probably doing something to...
What would it make if a fish costs $3 or $4 to your budget? Or what difference would it make? Besides, the subsidies are real money that are given to people that is taken away from school, from hospitals, from road building.
Well, what about the example of global warming and the solutions that would be required for that? It would certainly cost money, at least in the short term, to switch our infrastructure over to clean energy.
And how much did it cost? How much did the forest burning in California cost?
It costs a lot, but these are the devastation that global warming is going to cause will be a long-term effect, but the changes need to happen.
No, they have direct effect now. In California, the cost of this forest burning, this is tax money that will not go into schools. That is tax money that will not go into health system. It has, the resources are limited, and the damage mitigation will cost money, come from somewhere. This is already costing people money, global warming. The point is the insistence on people doing by themselves, people or citizens acting as consumers. This thing simply ignores the fact that we live in society that involves millions of people. And this million of people, we cannot reach them through agitation, distributing leaflets in front of a shop. We cannot reach them. And modern society organize themselves with governments. And if we're lucky enough to have a government that is democratic, then we work through the government. The notion that we can fix a problem like global warming by changing our private habits, me as a professor or you as a student, and then through this example, it's going to snowball all the way to where? All the way to nowhere. Because good causes like that are picked up by 5% of the population, and the rest is completely out of the loop because people have other problems. That's why we have government. People cannot organize a healthcare system, a school system by themselves. We don't do that. If we could organize things by ourselves, we would leave our hunter-gatherers.
So what about the case of what happened in the United States where we had someone, Hillary Clinton, who was at least going part of the way to want to fight global warming, and then Donald Trump, who said that not only will I do nothing.
He has been elected by people, so we have to work politically so that we don't elect such monsters. That's the point.
But the people voted for him.
The fact that we have Trump doesn't validate that we're going to solve climate change as a private issue.
I don't think it will, but it shows that the people need to become more educated. That somebody needs to educate them
about their power to influence, about how to select political leaders, not how to build a windmill themselves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We agree with you on the point that individual action is not sufficient and that governments need to be engaged and ultimately need to implement policies. Yes, for sure. I think that just what we were a bit confused about is that we were wondering to what extent it is also important to engage in, you could think of it almost as just public awareness campaigns to attempt to just change underlying sentiments. Well, I agree, it's not...
Public awareness, and we don't hear about going to Ottawa and Rizal. All the time we hear about public awareness. All the time, that's all we do.
So, Professor, one last question. We'd like to know what specifically you meant by asking us to become hellraisers. What would that look like to you?
That would be like, for example, and that's going to be not exclusive, but you join Greenpeace. Rather than sheep, because sheep do little things that clean up the beach, but Greenpeace raise hell. That's one example. When Harper was preventing people, government workers, from expressing their opinion, scientists went all the way to Ottawa and demonstrated. This demonstration actually contributed to turning lots of people against Harper.
I see. So by raise hell, you mean influence public opinion as well as influencing politicians. Is that correct?
Influence, that's right. Because politicians react to public opinion. The point is that the goal of any action on the environment is to reach politicians and to reach a political action, not to reach your friend who then will become a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm. But do you think there's some value in showing the politicians that we would be willing to accept some sacrifice? Or do you think that...
This is, obviously, when you talk to them, and when you are politically active, you cannot be a hypocrite and go hunting, dugong or manatees for your pastime. Yes, you have to be consistent with your political message. You have to be privately consistent with your political message. But it's not possible to change the world by being private, a better private person. You have to be a public person. You have to be a political person. That's my point.
Yeah, we definitely agree with you there.
Yeah, I'm really glad we had this conversation. I think we, I think you said a lot of...
So if you look at the last 50 years, the political changes that have happened, that have been pushed by students, or by young people, or by old people for that matter, you look at any political change that has happened, there is consciousness, indeed, there is organization, then there is a phase of raising hell and meeting the resistance that will come from politicians because they don't want to do this thing, and then they give up at some point, and they do what is necessary when the pressure becomes strong enough. But it never, never happens out of the goodness of anybody's heart. And good, being a good example, a good private citizen, you have to be politically active.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I definitely understand what you're saying, because while we have seen a lot of people, at least in our own small community, make changes in their own lives that do positive changes, we also encounter a lot of people who are not willing to make these changes. And so I think we all agree that...
And at some point, they have to, if you have used the force multiplier, then they have to stop smoking in public. They have to wear a safety belt. They have to vaccinate their children. That's another example. If people want to endanger ourselves, want to endanger us and our children by not vaccinating their kids, they have to be forced. And they have to be forced by law.
Mm-hmm.
That is the thing. We don't go out in the street convinced Madame John Doe that her beautiful child should be vaccinated. You pass a legislation that she cannot send her kid to school if she's not vaccinated, then that's it.
Well, thank you. I totally agree with that. I'm sure we'll get more than a few angry comments from certain people on our Facebook page after we air this, but
yeah, no, we think you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're about out of time, but thank you very much for this conversation again.
You're welcome.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on the show next week on Friday. What is it? Friday, March the 29th next week. So mm-hmm. We'll be featuring an interview with Joshua Catcher, who is the author and founder of a vegan men's fashion house, Brave Gentleman. And he has a new book coming out that is actually just coming out this week. So we look forward to having him on the show. And he has a lot of knowledge in the area of how fabrics and textiles have been historically used for using animal products, and how they can now there's new technology out where that can be phased out and we can just wear truly vegan clothing. So we here at Animal Voices, we want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts. You can read our show blog with detailed links and subscribe to us on iTunes and now on Google Play Podcasts. Stay in touch with us with our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and you can also email us at info@animalvoices.org. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to the Animal Voices show today, and remember to be kind to the animals.